I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the country's leading immunologist and head of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, testified before the House Oversight Committee yesterday about the threat of the novel coronavirus that he said was 10 times more lethal than seasonal influenza. Chairwoman Carolyn Maloney asked this question.
Is the worst yet to come, Dr. Fauci?
Yes, it is.
Can you elaborate?
Well, whenever you have an outbreak that you can start seeing community spread, which means by definition that you don't know what the index case is, and the way you can approach it is by contact tracing. When you have enough of that, then it becomes a situation where you're not going to be able to effectively and efficiently contain it. Whenever you look at the history of outbreaks, what you see now in an uncontained way, and although we are containing it in some respects, we keep getting people coming in from the country that are travel-related. We've seen that in many of the states that are now involved. And then when you get community spread, it makes the challenge much greater. So I can say we will see more cases, and things will get worse than they are right now.
Shortly after Fauci spoke, the World Health Organization declared the coronavirus was a global pandemic. We asked Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel to join us once again. He's Vice Provost of Global Initiatives at the University of Pennsylvania, a former Obama White House health policy advisor. And Zeke, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yes, good to be here, and sorry for the crunch that everyone's experiencing and uncertainty.
Absolutely, and I want to talk about all of that. I do want to quote Fauci again. He says, if we are complacent and don't do really aggressive containment and mitigation, the numbers will go up. So what should the United States do?
Well, I do think we have to recognize that we're probably not in the containment mode. I think if anything brings that home, it's Tom Hanks and the NBA. You know, we might be able to trace back, but it does seem to be in the community and around. And I think we need to therefore go into the mitigation strategy. What does mitigation strategy entail? Well, there are many things. You know, part of it is really emphasizing social distancing. Mm-hmm. And for the listeners, that means, you know, this is a droplet-borne illness. Droplets, when you speak and when you interact, are, you know, go about 2 to 3 feet. So there's got to be a 3 feet circle around you. So, you know, that's why many people and organizations are limiting crowds and density, so you don't have a lot of people collected in a small area packed in like sardines. It means rubbing down surfaces because of droplets to get them off and washing your hands. You know, I think mitigation strategy, we also need to make clear when you go to the doctor and when you don't. If you have a cough and you're worried about coronavirus, bad idea to go to your doctor. Hmm. I mean, if you have it, you're going to spread it to lots of other people, that's probably not the best option. So we need also to begin, different forms of testing, not going to your local doctor for the test. You know, in Korea, they have drive-through testing. Maybe that's something we need to put up. One of the big worries I've had right from the start, began talking about 2 or 3 weeks ago, is the surge capacity. Do we have the hospital capacity, the ventilators, the beds, the medical infrastructure to address this?
Well, let me pick up on several things. One, and I just heard a report about South Korea that apparently within a week they had 100 labs up and running, and they had learned from some previous infectious diseases about preparedness. You can get free testing. It's apparently easily available. As you mentioned, it's kind of drive-through in certain places. Why do you think South Korea seems to be so much more prepared than the United States?
Well, look, there's no sugarcoating it. We made a mistake. We, being the CDC, made a mistake in, you know, trying to develop its own test. When it developed its own test, sending it out to in a faulty way, having very high thresholds for who would be tested, a whole series of bad mistakes in judgment. This, You know, one of the things I've learned over the last 10 years since the passage of the ACA is this is a huge country, 325 million people today. It's very diverse, and you can't scale things through the government rapidly and effectively. You need to use the private sector. And so they've now discovered, well, we should use all those hospitals that develop their own tests. This is a relatively easy test because we have the genetic code. LabCorp and Quest, mega diagnostic testing can do it too. And that was probably a judgment that they needed to put in place right away rather than centralize it in Atlanta. We needed to distribute it. I think the centralization is it'll be like Ebola, just a few cases, or like SARS, just a few cases, rather than, involve tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people.
Well, can we assume that if and when there are more test kits, that we will find out that there is more coronavirus in the United States?
It's undoubtedly the case. Undoubtedly the case that we have tens of thousands and maybe more people infected now. The number of cases we have, the number of deaths we have is just, tip of the iceberg. How big that iceberg is a critical question. So one of the other things we need to do is a community surveillance I certainly would do it in Seattle to try to understand the outbreak there. But I think you need to do it in a couple of other places to try to understand how it's distributed. Maybe a place that hasn't reported so many cases like, pick random city, Atlanta, Philadelphia, plus a place that seems to have a lot of people in quarantine and a lot of suspected cases like New York City. So I think we need that community survey to give us a good sense for what's above the waterline and what's hidden in the community that we're not perceiving well now.
Zeke, I wanted to ask you about Italy, that has essentially shut the country down. The only thing, as I understand, that's operational are drugstores, food stores, banks, and perhaps some occasional public transportation. Do you think that's a smart way to try to contain this virus? And is that something the United States should think about? We're a much larger country, a much bigger economy. But nonetheless, do you think there are some lessons we can learn from that?
There are certainly lessons, and I do think this is something that would be good to have a vigorous debate on. So if you think about it for a second, and I've been thinking about it for, a little more than a second, but I will say I don't have a definitive view yet because it is a drastic step. But if you lock down the country for 3 weeks, then and people are really staying home, or they're only going out when they're walking in the woods, and so there's no one within hundreds of yards of them. Then within the house, if anyone has undiagnosed, they pass it around, and you extend everyone out past the 14-day incubation period. And so you've really dropped it down. You have to combine this with, obviously, restricting flights in, but you could really bring sort of quash it. Well, 3 weeks of isolation and basically no economic activity is a huge drop in the economy to everyone, and I think that's what's got everyone should we do it? First, it's got to be effective on a public health standpoint, and I think we need some modeling. Would that actually work? And the second is you have to be we probably need to do it even if it would be economically painful. Remember, the stock market dropping 20% and then this morning dropping another 1,700 points before trading was suspended. We've wiped out trillions of dollars. If we close the economy for a month, that's 1/12 of the economy. That's about $1.5 trillion. Is that worth it? Well, the alternative could be very, very bad. You hear Angela Merkel of Germany talking about 70% of the population infected. That would be a disaster, unmitigated economic, public health, psychological disaster to any country, because you would have massive rationing, you'd have massive numbers of people dying. 70% of this country is 210 million people. Even if 0.1% of those people die. We're talking about more than 200,000 people. I think it would, you know, think of what 9/11 did, and that was, whatever, 5, 6,000 people.
Sure. Couple of minutes before I know we have to say goodbye to you. I'm wondering, though, as much we don't know about this virus, but even looking ahead, do you think when the summer months come that will have any kind of impact on the virus and its spread? And how soon before a vaccine do you think would be tested and ready to go?
So the first question is, look, anyone who says they know is simply wrong. We don't know. You know, and both scenarios have plausibility to them. The scenario that it goes away is a lot of coronaviruses are seasonal. The influenza is seasonal, and this will be could be seasonal just like that. And, you know, end of April, early May, when it gets warm enough, we will see this float away. The converse of that is, well, it's popped up in Egypt, in Israel, in Singapore, places that are warm already. And, you know, it's like, and there are coronaviruses like the MERS virus, the Middle East Respiratory virus, that, you know, turns out not to be, doesn't appear to have any seasonality to it. So, you know, what do you know? Well, we know that we don't know. And you, therefore, if you're, you know, doing public health, you have to be very prudent and say, nah, you know, we can't base our policies on it's going to go away. If it goes away, that's a good thing. But remember that it's almost assuredly would come back in the fall, and we would face very similar circumstances. So, second, vaccine.
Look, yeah, is that our only hope at this point?
It may be. They're social distancing, or really massive employment of social distancing. And a vaccine isn't going to be here this season, and if it's seasonal, next season, because a year from now it'll be ready. So that's, you know, March, April, May next year, and if it's seasonal, that will be. So we won't have a vaccine effective for the third year of this virus, beginning, call it, fall of 2021. So we have to have a public health strategy that thinks of taking into account either something that isn't seasonal or something that is back with us for two seasons.
And Zeke, final question, when you talk about social distancing, are you telling us to stay home?
No, I'm not telling people to stay home. So I live literally right across from a major national park, you know, huge park. You know, I think it's fine to go running in that park, fine to go bike riding in that park. I'm not going to come in contact with anyone else. So I think, but it does mean that, you know, that is one major strategy we really need to contemplate. And as I said, I think we need to debate it vigorously over the next few days and see how the modeling goes and how the arguments go. I'm not a modeler, and I would love to have people model it and tell me whether that really does bring the
we got to go.
Sufficiently suppresses the number of people getting
Zeke
the
Emanuel,
disease to really have a bumper.
Thank you for joining us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Public health officials are telling us not to panic, to wash our hands, keep them off our face, don't shake hands with other people, keep a social distance from other people, take some common sense steps to help limit the spread of the coronavirus. Meanwhile, the NBA season has been suspended. Concerts and conferences have been put on hold. Italy is on lockdown. Houses of worship have shut their doors. Schools are being closed. College classes are going online. Nursing homes are banning visitors. Companies are telling their employees to work from home. It's hard to know how to feel when there is a global pandemic, how stressed to be, and what to do to manage anxiety and fear when things feel so uncertain, even out of control. We have two guests who have joined us. Catherine Belling, Associate Professor of Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She studies disease anxiety. Catherine Belling, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Jane Scher. She's a psychotherapist, co-founder of the Resilience Group here in Philadelphia. And Jane Scher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be with you, Marty.
And to our listeners, we do want you to join our conversation. Any questions or comments, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Jane, if I could begin with you, you're a psychotherapist. Are your patients talking about some of their worries about this coronavirus?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And it's really accelerated this week. It's as though last week we were living in a different world than we're living in right now.
And to you, Catherine Belling, I mean, we've lived through other viruses, other threats, even 9/11. I'm thinking of, you know, all the various disasters and crises that we have lived under. Is there something different about this one?
I think so. The biggest part, and I think it became most noticeable yesterday when the word pandemic became official, I actually went to my Oxford English Dictionary and checked that panic and pandemic do not actually have the same etymology and don't come from the same place. And we can talk about that a bit more.
Sure.
But I think the words kind of echo off each other. And I think it felt for many people as though things went to a different level in terms of anxiety. And I think that there's room for reassurance, for rethinking about, you know, our reactions to that word in particular. But I think, I think we're clearly in a different place than we were even a few days ago.
And pandemic means that it has shown up in most countries in the world, as I understand it.
And I think the important part is that, you know, the pan part just means everybody,
right.
Demic, you know, as in democracy, right? It means people. And so it's really, it's about numbers. It means that most people all over the world are potentially exposed to it. It doesn't say anything about what it is and how, you know, it doesn't mean that suddenly it's a more scary disease or that more people are going to get sick or die than it was when it was just an epidemic. But there's something about that word that makes people think in a more catastrophic way, I think, and it's worth, you know, sort of trying to keep that in proportion.
Absolutely. Jane, if I can go back to you, and I mean, we are in many ways dealing with the unknown. There are things that we are learning about this virus, but this much that we don't know about this virus. How does that feed our anxiety, and how do you suggest people, if not educate themselves, at least try to deal with the anxiety of the unknown?
Yeah, great question, because as human beings, we do not respond well to the unknown. We back off from things, or we exaggerate how bad the consequences are going to be. And so part of what we have to do is actually really learn about how our brain is designed to get us hyper alert and hyper vigilant to threat and danger, because we're going to have to work with our stress response system to try to lower it rather than just let it be free floating, reacting to all the moments of getting triggered by the media and by the facts also, and by the unknown of it.
What do you suggest people do? And it's funny you say, not funny like ha-ha, but funny that you say that, because even in putting this show together, you know, we want to help people not allay their fears, but at least manage their fears. But it's, you know, words matter, tone matters. All these things can really trigger someone's anxiety. Jane?
Yeah, well, you're talking about becoming aware and more mindful about our tone of voice, what words we're saying to ourselves, how much we're just automatically assuming worst case scenario and acting as though that worst case scenario is fact and actually going to happen.
Right.
So I'm having my clients say to themselves, right now, I am healthy. And keep repeating that. Right now, I am healthy. Stay with the facts. Right now, I have a job. Right now, things are working out. I don't know what's going to happen, and I need to stay in right now. I'm having people practice lots of different breathing techniques, sometimes using apps for that, such as Calm or Headspace. And I strongly encourage people to use these kinds of apps, because sometimes we can't get our nervous system to calm down sufficiently on our own. But if we listen for 10 minutes or 15 minutes to a guided imagery that helps us to do that, it really can make a huge difference.
Catherine, let me go back to you, and your area of expertise is disease anxiety, and we are talking about our bodies. We're talking about people getting sick. I mean, there's worry about climate change. There's worry about the stock market. There are all those other kinds of worries. But when the worry is so connected to our bodies, what is that anxiety about?
Well, part of it is that our bodies are where we react, where we feel anxiety. And so you've got two things going on at the same time. So climate change, no matter how much you're worried about it, is something that is, at least for now, external to yourself. But if you think, oh dear, what if I'm getting sick? Your body will react with a sped up heart rate. You might break out in a sweat, and then you might think, oh dear, my temperature is doing something strange because I broke out in a sweat. Maybe I have a fever. Maybe these are flu-like symptoms. And then the anxiety reaction can start to mimic exactly the kind of symptoms you might be worried about, which makes you feel more worried, and so on. And so there's always a kind of danger with your physical reaction to anxiety that can set up this kind of spiral. And I think one of the things is precisely the idea that you have that where you can say, I am healthy now. Mm-hmm. But I think also then once you get that panic under control, and I'll go back to what I was saying about panic, the term is based on the Greek god Pan, who used to make incredibly scary noises in the woods to frighten people away, so that people literally panicked, ran shrieking, not able to control themselves at all, and because he was wicked, he wanted to cause mischief. And so if you think about that, as you know, when you hear a scary noise and you have no idea what it is, but you're being teased by some kind of wicked deity, then you can stop and say, well, okay, that's not helpful, so I'm going to breathe, count backwards from 10, and then think rationally. And I think the important part there is remembering that anxiety, or maybe if we want to call it concern, which is a less disturbing term, think about what are my concerns, confront the fact that we are all uncertain at the moment, and then think about, okay, so what if the worst case scenario happens, and try to look at it in a cold way and think, okay, what would that look like? And then think as well, and this is the important part, which we always forget about when we think about anxiety, what if the best case scenario happens? And then think about yourself as not being at the worst case scenario point of the continuum, but being somewhere in the middle, thinking in both directions. I always try to think of anxiety as something that entails hope as well as fear. Huh. It's those two things. And we tend to always just go on to the fear side because that's where you get the sort of exciting stories, right? The hope part tends to be kind of boring, and that's really what we want at the moment. So I think it's playing that game. Once you have the initial kind of physical panic under control, is then to look carefully at the different possible scenarios and think about where you are in relation to them. Then turn to the really boring information. In other words, don't go to the sensationalistic stories that are going to produce that physical reaction again, but go to something like your local public health website where you've got the list of things you can do, like washing your hands, like not getting, you know, within a certain distance of people, like using your hand sanitizer and not touching your face, and look at the numbers, the statistical numbers that will say, at this point, your chances are probably not too bad. You can track them, not checking too many times a day to see what the numbers look like, and use those to keep yourself in a more rational position in relation to the uncertainty that we're all feeling at the moment.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Catherine Belling. She's associate professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She studies disease anxiety. Jane Scher with us as well. She's a psychotherapist, co-founder of the Resilience Group in Philadelphia. And again, we are talking about ways to manage some of the fears, whether rational or irrational, some of the anxieties related to the coronavirus, the country's response to the coronavirus. And we do want to hear from you. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jane, here's an email from Beth who says, I'm a 24/7 caregiver for my 96-year-old mother. I'm worried that by me even going to the grocery store or to my medical appointments, I will bring the virus back to mom. We're very careful with sanitizing, but we are so afraid. And again, it's sort of where we started our conversation, just sort of knowing the healthy, smart, appropriate degree of concern, if not fear. Can you speak to Beth's concerns?
Yeah, that I think that many people who are in Beth's situation have a lot of that kind of fear, and that we can only do the best that we can do right now, and we have to keep that in perspective. And what we're being told is that we need to retrain ourselves to keep our proximity from people, to set limits on touching, and that if we do that, we're doing the best that we can do, because she's got to also provide her mother with food, it sounds like.
Sure.
So we've got to keep going on with our lives and practice a lot of the hope that goes with how we navigate anxiety in all other situations. We've got to hope that if we do things, that it will eventually work out, and that we can't control things. Like, you know, we can't control other people's situations, and we can't control how this is all going to turn out. We can only take the steps that we can take.
Let me pick up on that. And we are talking about public health, which means we're talking about all of us, that we are all in this together. And I wonder, Catherine, whether there's something that we can get from that. And clearly, healthy people have to do things to stay healthy so they don't put the vulnerable people at risk. But is there a way to think about that we can sort of all be in this together and feel some support from each other?
Yes, absolutely. And most of my work is on hypochondria, what used to be called hypochondriasis, which is very often about the isolated person thinking, oh, what if I've got some kind of disease, and what should I do about it? A situation like this is very different because, as you say, we are all in it together, and it's very much more about, I think, thinking of how we can protect each other, how we can take care of ourselves, because obviously ourselves and our loved ones are the ones that we're most concerned about, but recognizing that this is really a quite extraordinary, I hesitate to say opportunity because one doesn't want to be too Pollyanna-ish about it, but in some ways I think it is. A way of recognizing how interconnected we all are in ways that I think sometimes it's quite tempting to forget. I think also, go ahead.
Well, Jane, sounds like you wanted to add something. Jane, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that there's also the side that we're all very different, and people are responding to this in a very different way. And some people are having people that they love and live with shame them because they're anxious and they're making decisions to do certain things or not do certain things. Mm. So how people experience anxiety is, you know, really is a range from 0 to 10.
Well, I'm thinking there some people are you know, trend more optimistic. Some people trend more pessimistic. That, Catherine, has got to sort of factor into how people are responding to this.
Absolutely. And if you think of that 0 to 10, you can also think of it as complete complacency at one end, which is dangerous because you'll take unnecessary risks and not prepare for harm that might come in the future. And at the other end, you've got that panic. But, you know, between the two, you have a whole range of varying levels of you know, smart and less smart responses. And I think the point is a very good one, not to shame people who are extremely anxious at this point, because it's perfectly reasonable to be extremely anxious. Because as you say, we really don't know where this is going. The thing is then how you manage that. And I think it's very important for us all to respect each other's responses to uncertainty. One of the other things that I was going to say, I was thinking this morning about possible good outcomes or good things to think about. When we talk about social distancing, it's really physical distancing we're talking about, right? Not breathing the same air, not touching the same surfaces and so on, not spreading the germs. But of course, we're in a better place now to not have to socially distance each other because of the technology we have than maybe ever before. And so we can actually be in quite, you know, supportive social contact with each other, even if we don't have to be physically in the same space. I was looking at my kids on their phones and thinking, you know, I'm actually glad that they've got all this social media because they can chat with their friends even if they have to stay home. So there's something kind of positive about that, that we're in touch in ways that we might not have been able to be under these circumstances.
Sure,
in the past.
And I'm so glad you raised that because, I mean, we are social creatures. And we're not at HYY. We don't want people who don't work here in the building. That's one of the reasons Jane Scherer is joining us by telephone. And
right. We're
sort of learning to hold, you know, if you see someone, not to shake their hand. So there are things that we are learning to do, at least temporarily, and to try mm-hmm. to contain this virus. But Jane, we are social creatures. We need human contact.
We do. And, you know, we also are in an active retraining of ourselves.
Yes.
I am retraining myself not to put my hands on my face in all kinds of different ways that I have
habitually
done.
It's really hard
and
to do.
As
too.
We're retraining ourselves, we're at risk of our inner critic rearing its ugly head with that tone of voice you were talking about earlier, Marty, putting us down, getting mad at us, making us feel bad, and then getting us more anxious. So our self-talk needs to get very practiced around being kind mm-hmm. and supportive of ourselves as we retrain many different ways in which we live our daily lives.
Well, I'll tell you what, we have to take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. Self-talk is the conversations that we're having with ourselves all the time. That's Jane Scherer. She's a psychotherapist, co-founder of the Resilience Group, which is here in Philadelphia. Catherine Belling, associate professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, and she specializes in disease anxiety. We are talking about how to deal with our anxiety related to the coronavirus, what we know and don't know, and how to take care of ourselves when we don't know the answers to everything. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. What do you want to know as we move forward dealing with this coronavirus? We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with our guests about some of the smart, the healthy ways to manage the stress of living with the threat of the coronavirus. And again, Catherine Belling and Jane Scherer are our guests. A Facebook comment from Nell says, one of my four children is very anxious about the virus. His school is not closed yet, but it's hard to navigate how to help him handle all the fears and all the news. Jane, if I can toss that to you first, but Catherine, I'd love to hear what you have to say as well. What do you suggest, Jane?
I think that parents have to help kids put this in perspective, that this is a virus that they're trying to limit the spread of, just like when we get the flu, they try to limit the spread of the flu, and that most people who do end up getting this are going to be ill for a while, like happens with a bad flu, and then they're going to be well again. And so we've got to generate hope that if it should happen, because it's going to happen to some people,
sure.
that we recover from it for the most part, especially kids, right? So far, we have not seen children being the most vulnerable of the population.
Well, it's interesting, Catherine. Part of the email was, you know, the fear related to the news. And, I mean, news is everywhere, as we know. Mm-hmm. How do you suggest people modulate their intake of news, especially about the virus?
It's hard to do. I think you want to stay informed. At the same time, you want to be selective or at least critical about how you listen to the news, and recognize again that you know news sells by noisy, exciting stories. And what we really want, as I said, is kind of the boring news. And so you know, which is sort of a contradiction in terms. One of the things that I think about is you know, we feel like we know we're in a movie that we've seen, right? Where all the headlines and those maps with the dots getting bigger and bigger. It's a narrative that is familiar, and to keep reminding ourselves that we don't know how this story goes. The uncertainty is important. We don't know that this is going to turn into that kind of, you know, conventional. I don't want to say a horror story, but, you know, the sort of pandemic or apocalyptic kind of story, and to recognize that those kind of familiar plots that we sort of think that we're seeing in the news does not mean that that's where we're going, and to be able to kind of stop and take a breath and be patient and say we don't know how the story is going to go, how things are going to turn out, and we must, you know, stay in the moment. And also that we, unlike when you're watching a movie, we have some power over mm-hmm. how the story is going to go. I spent some time yesterday explaining the flatten the curve model to my 13-year-old, who is also, you know, she's kind of concerned at the moment, unsurprisingly, and showing her how that worked and how all the things that we are doing about washing our hands and so on can help to spread that out, and that it even means that if the pandemic lasts for longer, and like the very sharp spike, it might mean that things are more under control. And I think she's found, and then she found the image online somewhere and saw that other people are thinking about that same pattern. And I think that was helpful because it's a kind of image you can hold in your mind, and that, you know, you talk to your friends and sort of say, we're all flattening the curve. We're right. all doing these things to make it not, you know, make the numbers not spike right up like that. And I think that's a kind of concrete, practical thing that you can, you know, and that kids particularly can sort of think that they're doing that's efficacious.
I think it also gives an explanation for why we're doing these public health strategies, because most human beings don't have any idea of really why this is happening.
Right.
And they're just interpreting it from the fear-based message that they're getting. They're not really understanding the logic of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another thing that I have been encouraging people to do, Marty, is to turn off the TV more and turn on music more, and in particular, music that you sing along to.
Oh, really? Why? Mm. Why is that?
Because it activates more of those positive neurochemicals that help induce hope and optimism and help manage our nervous system without our having to rely on the thinking mind to do it. You know, when it comes to fear, the neurochemical reaction of cortisol and adrenaline that gets exploded in the brain doesn't get mediated very well by thinking. It gets mediated way better by trying to change the neurochemicals. And that usually involves doing something with the body, singing, breathing, reciting a poem, saying, you know, something you've memorized at some point in your life.
And that helps to kind of keep that anxiety in line. Catherine, let me go back to you. I mean, we played a clip of Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier, the country's leading infection specialist. There are experts in this country, and I don't mean this as a political statement, but I think part of our problem is that we have had a president. He had a press Oval Office speech that he gave last night, but a president who has given us misinformation and wrong information, who continues to shake hands with people. And I wonder how, as the public, we process that.
Right. Well, it's part of the uncertainty is that we are getting different information from different sources, and are seeing contradictory things happening. I think again, as I said, go back to the really boring source, which is the useful
CDC.
One, your own public health CDC or your local public health site, even more so, because then that will apply much more directly to you. And try not to be too caught up in what is anyway a rapidly changing narrative. And I think again about how we're all in this together, because I think there's a danger in imagining that other people or people from other countries are the source of potential harm, and much more that we all of us have an opportunity to resist this together. I mean, globally as well as you know, in the United States and in your neighborhood. And I think to that extent, try to tune out the contradictions and go to a source of more clear and concrete information and advice from a reliable public health source.
Here's an email from Megan. How would your guests approach someone with PTSD surrounding health issues? Jane, So someone that's already kind of, you know, in a higher state of anxiety about their health anyway, are there things that they can do specifically?
I would say for anybody who's got PTSD, it's really important to work with regulating your breathing, because it's in the techniques of regulating our breathing that we're able to get some of that neurochemistry that makes us hyped up to calm down. One quick and dirty that I like to teach people is if you put your hand on your belly and you, as you inhale, expand your belly like a balloon. Mm. And as you exhale, pull the belly button to the back, and to continue to do that, 5 rounds, 10 rounds of inhaling and expand the belly and exhaling and pulling the belly button to the back. What that breath does is it sends a signal to the brain to shut off the production of cortisol and adrenaline. And by giving the mind something to do that directs thinking and the body to do something, we really can help to offset the anxiety and the trauma-inducing action of the brain on the body.
I mean, it's so interesting that our brain, you know, I guess our brain can drive us crazy, right? That should not be a revelation. But I'm wondering too, Catherine, I'm thinking about medical school students who are studying all these diseases, and then they feel like they're contracting the diseases. Is there something similar you think that might be happening with the public?
I think that's a great point. We're at the moment, all of us, unavoidably worrying about health, because that's what the biggest, you know, it's the biggest issue that everybody is being, you know, necessarily worried about at the moment. And I think we've all got a little bit of information, and our bodies, as I said, react to that information by doing things, by producing symptoms. And I think that idea of the breathing is really good, because if you're panicking, you know, again, to go back to this idea of running around when the God Pan makes those scary noises and you can't think straight, you're just trying to get away. If you stop, stand still, and do those slow, big breaths, immediately whatever part of your brain is saying we're in panic mode will stop and say, oh, no, wait, we can't be, because we're standing still and we're breathing very slowly. And I think, you know, again, I think that's significant, because then you shut down that cycle of physical symptoms, which you could then misinterpret as being actual symptoms of disease. So, you know, the thing is that because of that feedback loop between the anxiety, between, as you say, your brain driving you crazy, right? Your mind is reacting to what your body's doing, which makes your body do more things, sure, which then your mind interprets. And so anything that breaks that cycle will enable you to then stop and think, okay, well, where are we really, and what's a more measured response?
And Jane, we don't know how long this is going to last. So, you know, how long can we, if people are in a higher state of alertness or anxiety or vigilance, that's exhausting emotionally to be that sort of ready, sort of the fight or flight thing is geared up.
It's exhausting, and it causes more vulnerability to the body, right? Perhaps even more vulnerability to the body than the coronavirus. You know, I think the other thing people have to keep in mind is, if I get it, it's most likely going to be like having a bad flu. Have I ever had a bad flu? For those people who are immune suppressed and have conditions like asthma or diabetes and immune suppression, they're at more risk, for sure.
Absolutely.
For those who don't fit that criteria, we are at risk mostly of getting something that's going to be unpleasant, not fun, set us back in some ways, but it isn't going to ultimately be life-altering. It's going to be a short-term
and then we're going to recover from it.
And to keep that in mind. I'm wondering, Catherine, and I happen to know two people who are self-quarantining. What help do people need if they are basically in isolation, which, you know, if you're going to be smart about it, it has to be 14 days or something to that effect. What do you suggest? I know actually several people are doing this. What do you suggest to help people deal with the isolation of self-quarantine?
I'm probably not the best person to ask because I'm naturally quite happy to be isolated in some ways. But I think what I was saying again is that we've never been in a better place technologically to be physically alone and not too severely isolated. And I think that's something to be grateful for. To reach out in all the various ways you can, FaceTime or Skype or social media or, find online support groups. I mean, I'm at the point, I teach at Northwestern, and we're at the point where much of our teaching may be moving to distance learning. And to think about that the distance is physical, but the connections remain, and we have a lot of ways of actually not being isolated, even if you're quarantined. And so I think maintaining connections in whatever ways are available is incredibly important and something that we've never been in a better position to do.
I think we also have to have discretion about who we're maintaining active conversation with. Some people can help activate our anxiety even worse, and we need to limit how much we're having contact with those people. And for those who are, managing this, I would say be really mindful of what kind of television you're watching. Mm-hmm. Watch shows that are going to be, keeping you laughing or engaged, and limit how much news you're watching. Read books, listen to books, put music on, create a project.
Do something, you're saying. And Jane, I guess if we're with someone and they make us feel more anxious, then maybe we shouldn't be talking to them. Is that what you're saying?
I think we need to limit how much contact we're having with them. Yes, we're going to have family members and friends who are going to be more anxious or make us more anxious than we might otherwise be. And so that's part of the social distancing, is for a while I need to pull back from how much contact I have with that person because it's activating me and I can't change them. So I've got to modify my contact with them.
Catherine, I'm giving you the last word. Any final thoughts before we have to say goodbye?
I think, again, I would go back to the idea that everybody is uncertain, and that there may be opportunities here in the long run, and I don't want to diminish the real risk that there is to many people, and that, that some people are genuinely feeling fear, reasonably, but at the same time, there is a real opportunity here for us to rethink a lot of the things we've taken for granted for a very long time, and to recognize that, we're in it together, and we'll probably come out of it okay on the other side.
Well, I do appreciate both of you joining us today in Radio Times. Catherine Belling, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's associate professor at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She studies disease, anxiety. Jane Scher, thank you very much as well.
And thank you, Marty, for all the great work you do informing the public.
Thanks so much. I appreciate that. Jane Scher is a psychotherapist, co-founder of the Resilience Group, which is here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. Couldn't do the show without them. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.